From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made Tuesday, January 15, 2013, when Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the New York SAFE Act into law. The package of reforms came in response to the Sandy Hook shootings, Governor Cuomo saying there was urgency to pass meaningful changes to the law. One of those was a ban on what the state calls assault-style weapons. Gun owners who currently possess assault-style weapons are required to register them with the state. They cannot give them away to others. They cannot give them as gifts upon their death. And a group called Scope has asked the state to release the number of registrations. They wanted to know if people are actually following this law. Their Freedom of Information request was honored, and last week we finally saw how many gun owners are following the law. The answer is apparently not very many. Police estimate that there are at least 1 million assault-style weapons in the state, perhaps as many as 2 million, but only 44,500 have been registered. That's between 2 and 5% of all assault-style weapons. Scope's president says this is proof that the vast majority of gun owners in the state have no respect for the law and are ignoring it. He says it's not working. Is he right? This hour, we look at where the SAFE Act is now, what those numbers mean. The New York State Legislature recently wrapped up its session, and despite some noise about the SAFE Act, nothing really happened with the SAFE Act in this past session. My guests for this hour include Chris Eads, who is the chair of the Monroe County chapter of Scope. Chris, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you, Evan.
And also here is Gary Putup from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. He's also a retired police lieutenant. Nice to see you, Gary.
Hello, Evan.
And also we want to mention to our audience that we invited a couple of members of the state legislature to join us today. Both have been vocal in their opposition to the SAFE Act in various ways. Assemblyman Bill Nojay declined our invitation. Senator Rich Funke is apparently traveling and is unavailable this hour. But we've got Chris and Gary here, and I want to start with Chris Eads. From Scope, Scope wanted these numbers. You got the numbers, 44,500 out of an estimated at least 1 million. What do those numbers say to you?
Well, it says that people aren't complying with the law. And I want to clarify Scope's position. When you say, you know, we don't have any respect for the law, I think it's important to realize that when a law is unconstitutional, right, let's draw an analogy with the First Amendment. Right? Say the government passed a law saying, journalists cannot criticize the government. And you said, I'm not going to follow that law. In fact, I'm going to go on my radio show and say that law is wrong, right? And then eventually it's found unconstitutional. The police cannot go back and say, well, while it was on the books, before it was unconstitutional, you broke the law, so we're going to arrest you, right? Because when a law is unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional from day one. And if you were convicted, you could have your conviction vacated. So what, you know, I think this is a similar situation. We believe this law is unconstitutional, and therefore there is no duty to obey an unconstitutional law.
Okay, and the reason I use that comment or that characterization, it came directly from Scope's president, Stephen Allstadt. I know you know his quote was about this. He said, quote, the majority of gun owners and sportsmen in New York have absolutely no respect for this law.
Right, yeah, and I just wanted to clarify what we mean by that,
because okay.
It's very easy to take one sentence like that and, you know,
sure.
and make it look a certain way.
I understand the point. Gary Putup, first of all, that number, to me, did look very low. It does appear that very few gun owners are registering their assault-style weapons. Do you disagree with that point?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we always like to do is deal with facts.
Yeah.
And the one of the problems we've had is that Scope and the NRA likes to play loose and fast with the facts. And in fact, I would say this, and the New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, in our statement in regards to this, actually in a sense applauds what Scope did to finally try, that they are finally trying to get some transparency and base facts, because the NRA has historically been against the collection of any kind of data. We know this from the passage of the Terhart Amendments. We know this even on a state level. Scope has always been one to publicly speak about the collection of any kind of data, the support of any, of financing through tax dollars, or even private release of information in regards to gun violence and gun data. And they come out with this, well, there's between 1 and 2 million guns, these assault rifles in New York. So my first question is based on what? And that's the answer you get. First of all, that number comes from information provided by the gun industry. So, but they never say this. So, one, we have to question the accuracy of that.
Of how many actual weapons exist in the state.
Yes.
The police don't seem to be disputing that. You're a retired police lieutenant yourself.
Yeah, because no one knows.
Okay.
And so, that of course, that's an issue. And what's important in bringing that up is to make sure it's not that shiny object that diverts us from what the real problems are. And I think, quite frankly, I think this backfired a little bit on Scope in the NRA, as we saw in this weekend's editorial from the Democrat and Chronicle. And if we pay attention, editorials and feedback from throughout the state, that somehow, and I have copies of Scope's official newsletter encouraging people to disobey the law, to not comply with this law.
And again, Chris just said,
yep,
that's coming from a point of them, their belief that it is not constitutional.
Right. And you know, that's kind of a dangerous precedent to begin with. First of all, Chris's analogy is not a good analogy. You know, to sit back and say that they believe in the rule of man and not the rule of law. I don't know if that, especially when we're dealing with the kind of violence that we've been seeing in this country, 33 people are dying from gun violence a day. You know, we don't need to get into, you know, the horrific types of things that are being accomplished with military-style weapons, like in Charleston. And, you know, to sit back and say, well, this is somehow a belief and we're going to let it work through the courts, is this has worked its way through the courts. Safe storage has worked its way through the courts. Regulations have worked its way through the courts, both in Connecticut and New York. And I think it's important to note that this same strategy was used in Connecticut by the NRA when Connecticut banned assault rifles, that the NRA went in and its affiliates went into Connecticut and said, see, nobody's obeying the law. But then what happens is what is happening in New York, we are finding that the rate of gun violence is going down, that things are better, our police are more safe. I mean, we can look at and just see what happened up in the North Country. Certainly, could you imagine if those guys, you know, had escaped from Dannemora and had access to assault rifles, which the probability that they could have is lessened in New York by these laws.
All right, but hold on. Let me just back up one second here, because I think, first of all, Gary's right. We don't know exactly how many military-style weapons there are. That estimate of a million to 2 million, is pretty commonly held. We hear it from police. Gary's saying, we don't know. Okay. If I grant the point, though, that maybe it's far less, maybe it's half, maybe it's 500,000, that still means fewer than 10% of assault-style weapons have been registered in this state, and that's still a small number, is it not?
And I will do this. Let us argue your point. That let us say that the million-dollar figure, or excuse me, the million assault rifle figure is accurate. First of all, it's important to know that this wasn't one assault rifle for one person.
The number of people
registering and the number of guns are not necessarily.
It was about 24,000 people, roughly. I think 24 to 25,000 people had registered roughly 44,500 firearms. So right. Just almost two weapons per person.
So I mean, I would propose this to think about this: if we are in a situation where we have a million assault rifles floating around in New York State, and considering what we have gone through with mass shootings in this country, that what this really points out is not that people are not complying with the law. This is a small group of individuals who feel they have a right to rebel, engage in armed rebellion against the country. We see what that's done in South Carolina. We see how important it is to have an accurate understanding of history. What this really shows us, and I would, if your figures are right, if those figures are right,
sure,
is that this problem is out of control, that this is a long overdue law. If you're telling me that there's a million assault rifles out there, and you know that we have people, the Dillon Roofs aren't restricted to moving outside of South Carolina, then this state and this nation has an issue that needs to be addressed.
And I think that's what the Democrat and Chronicle is saying in their editorial. I think that there are two different commentaries happening. I think New Yorkers Against Gun Violence is saying, as you said, I'm not sure that there are that many weapons, and we shouldn't just assume no one is complying. But the Democrat and Chronicle is saying, if very few people are complying, that's got to change. And I think that's more what I'm hearing from those who agree with your position, Gary, is that, okay, we've seen the numbers. They have to be higher.
Well, we're saying, I think we're on the same page on both those points, in that we are saying the way to disagree with a law that has been found constitutional time and time again, and this is why Chris's analogy falls a little short, is this: these laws have been found constitutional time and time again. And I'm not sure the majority of people in this state believe that the right answer is saying, see, we encourage people not to obey the law. They don't obey the law, so therefore we should get rid of the law, is a logical way to draft and legislate in this state.
All right, let Chris respond to a number of points there, including this, Chris, because right. I want to give you plenty of time to address all of those, but within what we want to talk about is this. Is Scope telling its members, we don't think this law is constitutional, therefore we'd like to see it repealed, and until it is, ignore it, disobey it, or are you saying it's not a surprise that people are disobeying it?
Yeah, it's not a surprise. We're not telling people not to comply with the law. And of course, you know, there's always some personal risk, right? If you believe it's unconstitutional, you know, the law is still on the books right now, and there's a personal risk to defying it. But as we believe it will be found unconstitutional, once that happens, then people who are not complying will be retroactively justified by that particular ruling. And I'd like to address Gary's points with the mass shootings, because I think people don't really understand what these, quote, assault weapon, unquote, what that definition means, right? So it's a semi-automatic rifle or shotgun or pistol that has certain characteristics. And I just like to run through them and try to, how would this affect the sort of mass shooter situation that we are familiar with? So things like a folding or telescoping stock, and I know people on the radio can't see this, but, it allows you to brace the weapon against your shoulder, right? If you're going to sit there in a fixed position and engage people. And that's not usually what these people do when they go on a shooting spree. They don't stay in one place. The thumb hole stock is just a place where the grip, like there's a hole that you can insert your thumb in, right? It might give you a little better ability to hold the weapon. Same thing with a second hand grip or pistol grip. I mean, these are ergonomic features that make it easier for people to hold a weapon, if they're at the range and they're standing still and they're releasing a high volume and they want to control the recoil and stay on target, or for, say, disabled people that have trouble holding a weapon normally. And these are things that you want if you're staying in a relatively static situation and trying to have a high rate of fire.
At what point does the average person need to be in a static situation and engaging in a high rate of fire?
Mostly it would be, say, down at the range, right? They're not...
For fun?
Yes, for placing things on target.
Okay.
And let me just finish here. There's like a bayonet mount, and people are not in that sort of mass shooting type situation. They're not really using a bayonet at that point. Flash suppressor. I mean, if you're, going around shooting people, people can hear where you are. You don't need the flash suppressor is, again, not the kind of thing that's going to help with a massacre, right? I mean, these are not things that are going to make that sort of situation more dangerous. The last one is a grenade launcher, and I'm okay with that. I'm okay with the grenade launcher being on that list.
Banned.
Right, yes. But,
can agree that there is a line. We're just haggling over where the line is.
Right. Actually, right. The grenade launcher, okay, that makes the weapon more dangerous. But the rest of these things, like, maybe could be helpful sometimes in a sort of like a combat situation, but it's not the kind of situation where the guy down in Charleston is going to be able to use these features to kill more people.
Okay.
They're mostly things that make gun look
I understand
evil.
That point. I also understand that most deaths related to firearms are not with these assault-style weapons. But
right. But
when we see the large numbers of people, why did Sandy Hook involve that kind of weapon? Why did the Aurora, Colorado, if what you're saying is true, that those weapons really aren't that useful in killing a lot of people in a short amount of time, then why were they used for that?
Actually, the Sandy Hook, I know the AR-15 was not actually used. It was just found in his car.
Chris, I have to stop you there.
Okay, hold on. Just as the show host.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I don't know exactly what...
But that's kind of a moot point, because I think people may be gravitating towards this just because it makes them like feel more powerful. Or a lot of these guns are also designed to like look evil, Right. And perhaps evil is not the right word. Look dangerous.
Menacing. Look menacing.
Right. Okay. And that's more of a psychological thing, I think. And you know, if you're going to use it for self-defense, that's something you'd want to have, right? It's just so you wouldn't have to pull the trigger. No. If it just looks bad enough, people won't attack you.
No, that's not why I would want. I would never want to use that thing for self-defense because I'd have to store it in a place that I could get to it easily. And that I've got a 3-year-old in the house, and if I could get to it easily, he could probably get to it easily, right?
Right.
Because if it's in a safe, then it's not really for self-protection, is it?
Well, there are such things as quick access gun safes, but. But yeah, if you're say in your home, you probably want to use more like a handgun.
Yeah, and again, I am just trying to walk through logically, and Chris is kind enough to help me understand some of these things. Because if somebody bursts into your house and wants to harm you, which thankfully is almost certainly not going to happen to anyone hearing this broadcast, we don't have to live in fear that every single day that is going to happen or is likely to happen. It is a vanishingly small amount of times that it will happen. And if it does, we're all terribly sorry. But if it does, and your gun is in a safe, you don't really have time to uncrack a safe.
If I could, because I have more experience in this than no offense, Chris, than Chris does.
Well, you're with a retired my law police lieutenant, but
all one has to do is travel down to Field and Stream, down at Marketplace Mall, Gander Mountain, mm-hmm. or go onto any number of websites. There are safes now. In fact, Tom King from the New York State Pistol and Rifle Association here in New York has said that, yes, you should be using these types of things because they're so easy to use. And there's two important points to make here. Some of them are simply as easy as sticking your finger on a pad, reading it biometrically, which means that no one but you can get in there, which is an added safety feature.
Okay, that's great.
In addition, it pops open. And not only that, if you're talking about this fantasy, I'm going to be invaded, I need to get my AR-15, fine. First of all, again, and I mean, we've been down this road before. The AR-15, you know, you can have this debate as to whether even that's a good home defense weapon. There's nothing in the SAFE Act. There's nothing in any of these other laws that prohibit people from owning firearms that are appropriate for home self-defense. But I want to be just, and I'm not sure I want to get hung up on the technicalities of these things because we've talked about, you know, these features that make these weapons as dangerous as they are.
But Chris is arguing that we are misunderstanding them, that they are not.
Well, I don't think the Department of Defense is misunderstanding them. The Department of Defense just recently put out another request for proposal to replace the M4, which is the descendant of the M16. And all those features are specifically mentioned to be on there because it makes it an effective military weapon. And one of the things, so to get away from that, because I think that argument's been settled, that if the Department of Defense, the Marine Corps, and the Army says we need these for this reason, I don't know why we continue to debate that. But I think what is important here is one of the things that Chris said. And in fact, I brought some materials on the choice of weapons in mass shootings, and they are always these military-style weapons. We now know from reports that Roof tried to access and get a hold of an AR-15 to do this shooting. But what he was left with was a high-capacity Glock pistol, which wouldn't be legal in New York, thank God. And one of the reasons he chose the Glock and why it is a favorite of mass shooters is, again, it was designed for military purposes, not for self-defense, not for defending your home against invaders. It was a handheld, basically killing machine with high capacity rounds. If he could have gotten an AR-15, as we now know, he would have. And I think it's really important that we start to move beyond arguing as to whether a pistol grip is how that does. But one of the things that I wanted to point out, and I think this is the problem we have with mass shootings, and we're going to have to deal with, is like Chris said, these weapons make people, and I'm going to use his words, they make them feel powerful. Now, when you're dealing with someone like Dylan Roof and many of these mass shooters who are in a situation where, as Chris said, it's a psychological issue where this weapon makes them feel powerful and gives, as his words, give them pleasure, that's enough for us as a sane society to start to sit back and say, you know, what's wrong with this picture? And that is what the gun industry has done. You know, I've talked about this time and again. All one needs to do is go to Wegmans or Tops and look at the gun magazines and see what's pushed. They're not even hunting rifles, and everything's tactical. It's a tactical weapon. I need a laser sight. I need, the forward grip. These aren't things for self-defense. These aren't things for hunting. This country has a gun violence problem, and we need to get past a little bit just the technical stuff and get to that.
Now, let me at least, as the host of this program, who is often saying it is very important for myself and for our listening audience to be willing to change your mind, I think something happened in this half hour, or at least I learned something new. I've often thought if you've got a gun in a safe at home, that's not a good reason to have it for self-protection, because if you need it in a pinch, no one's going to wait for you to figure out the combination. But I was not aware of the biometric sensors that they seem to work. Gary, you seem to be indicating that you can get that they work pretty well. Is that right?
Oh, not only they work well, but there's other ones. And frankly, you know, and I've talked about this before, I'm a gun owner. And one of the safes that I keep my handguns in has a simple four-button combination.
But forget the buttons. Are there safes where you press a finger and boom, it's open?
Yes.
Okay, they work pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so
But Fox News had a whole morning special showing how well they worked, and they had somebody from the gun industry promoting this. I give the gun industry this, is you will see that they're pushing this. The National Shooting Sports Foundation.
Yeah.
Even the NRA has pushed. Tom King from New York State Rifle and Pistol Association has always said, you know, if you have a gun, you should keep it locked up. You should keep the ammunition locked up separately, too. But the whole point is, there's no validity to this argument that I need a gun that handy that I can't keep it locked up.
I'm just saying that when it comes to a safe, there must be, I was not aware of the safes that work as well.
Invite you to, you know, head down to the Gander Mountain.
I should invite them on this program because important to learn new things. And so at least I appreciate that. Chris, go ahead.
Yes. Yes, Gary. I know that's part of your agenda as well, the safe gun storage. But I'd like to go back to what you said about the assault weapons making people feel powerful, because we're talking about constitutional rights here. And we're saying we're going to restrict these constitutional rights because it makes people feel a certain way. Well, what if the guy had one of those five-hour energy drinks and it made him feel stronger to have that five-hour energy drink, and that made him, you know, more confident to go on his mission of destruction? I mean, are we going to ban those things because it made the guy feel stronger? Is that a reason to restrict constitutional rights because they make people feel a certain way? You know, and I know that some people makes people feel nervous, right, simply to see a gun. And that is a motivation behind a lot of gun control, right? But I don't think it's a correct motivation, just, you know, because it makes people feel a certain way.
Well, I think there's a critical difference here, and I think there's, again, these analogies that the industry likes to use, like when they try to say that guns and cars are the same. Obviously, there's a difference. The first difference is five-hour energy drinks are not designed to kill large numbers of people in a short amount of time. That's a problem. So with the analogy, the second problem is Dylan Roof and others can drink all the five-hour energy drinks they want. They're not going to be able to walk in with a military-style weapon and slaughter people inside a church. That's a critical difference. And again, and I bring this up again and again, and I've yet to hear an answer from anybody in the gun industry or from SCOPE or the NRA, exactly what part of this is unconstitutional. Because even in Heller versus D.C., the Supreme Court has said these types of regulations are constitutional. So basically, the argument is being made that because somebody thinks that somehow, and based on no cases, that this is going to be found unconstitutional, when in fact the history is it's been found constitutional time and again, that they can break the law, is flawed logic.
Chris?
Well, that's very, I mean, okay. Right. I mean, the Supreme Court in D.C. versus Heller, and a lot of the things, you know, and I don't know exactly what they are, but a lot of what you're citing as precedent may be before D.C. versus Heller, where Second Amendment was found to be an individual right. you know, what D.C. versus Heller said is there may be some restrictions based on the kind of weapon. And the court at that time did not get into what those could be. But when you're dealing with constitutional rights, there's a certain thing called strict scrutiny, which means that these regulations have to be justified. They can't just be, well, we think it's a good idea, so we're going to pass the law. There has to be a good justification. There has to be a public need, and it has to be the least restrictive way to address that public need. And so, and you know, I just have to disagree that things like a folding stock or a flash suppressor, you know, are going to make a difference in this kind of situation that we're talking about in Charleston. You know, I just they're not going to be the deciding factor. And in fact, in China, like just about the same time, right, this guy went on a stabbing spree, killed 33 people with a knife. You know, and that seems to suggest that, you know, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a gun. I mean, this guy in China killed 33 people with a knife, and maybe it was easier because he knows, you know, people in China aren't allowed to own guns and can't shoot back and stop his killing spree, right? I mean, there was a woman in a church a few years ago that was armed, a concealed carry, you know, down in Texas, and when somebody entered her church to try to shoot it up, she pulled out a gun and shot the guy and ended it right there. And I think if we're
looking
for...
You don't have nearly... I get that point, but you don't have a whole lot of cases where someone plays the hero. You can find them. They happen.
But the reason is that these are...
But you have a whole lot more where someone plays into a tragedy.
There's plenty of peer... There's plenty of peer-reviewed evidence that the idea that having a gun makes you safer is incorrect.
Okay, but Chris, go ahead.
Yes. Well, I mean, a lot of the reason is that almost all of these mass shootings happen in gun-free zones, like schools. And we have passed laws saying you can't have a gun here, you can't shoot back, and that's why they go there to conduct their shootings, because no one can shoot back. And so it's to say, you know, so yes, a lot of times it's a tragedy, and that's because we've passed laws prohibiting people from defending themselves in these areas.
Now, let me just try to clarify here. I'm jumping online. I see multiple cases where some have questioned whether Adam Lanza used a Bushmaster. The Connecticut State Police were asked to clarify, and this is the definitive comment from the Connecticut State Police. To clear up any confusion, the shooter used the Bushmaster 223 to murder 20 children and 6 adults inside the school. He used a handgun to take his own life inside the school. No other weapons were used in this crime in this case.
Right.
That is definitive from the Connecticut State Police. So if we're going to trust police on the number of a million or more assault-style rifles or weapons in this state, I will also trust them that they've got it right on what Adam Lanza used in that. So Chris might not like that. Gary might not like the fact that I'm trusting police in a million or more, but there we are. We're late for a break. We're going to get a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about where we are with the SAFE Act. If you're just joining us, Scope asked the state to release the numbers on registered assault-style weapons in the state's definition, and it turns out only about 44,500 have been registered. If that sounds like a lot, consider that police have it sort of gone along with the estimates that there are at least a million of these firearms in this state. And what that number tells you is between 4% and 5% total at the high end is what has actually been registered. Scope is saying this is evidence that people are ignoring this law, that it is not working. It's time to repeal it. When we come back, we'll get some of your phone calls. We'll talk about the fact that the state legislature decided to do nothing in this legislative session, despite a lot of talk. Is that a disappointment to Chris? To gun owners? What does Gary say about that? Well, let's continue the conversation after this break on Connections.
Okay.
Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about what nonviolence really means. A group from the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester recently spent 16 days in South Africa. They studied history, learned about principles of nonviolence. They're coming back to Rochester with a renewed focus on how to apply those principles here. We'll talk about that next hour.
Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff is about to visit the U.S. Back home, she's having problems.
She wouldn't want this relationship to be another problem. Quite on the contrary, she wants that to be smooth, because it might be helpful.
Brazil's leader comes to Washington and the last decisions of a historic Supreme Court term. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guests for the hour are debating where the New York SAFE Act stands, and we frame it that way because not that there are changes to the law. The New York State Legislature recently concluded their legislative session and decided not to address it at all. But we did see some numbers released last week. Scope convinced, through Freedom of Information, the state to release the numbers, and the number of registrations for assault-style weapons is apparently pretty small. 44,500 registered by about 25,000 people, which indicates that most of those style weapons in the state remain unregistered despite the SAFE Act. Let's get our first phone call, and this is Gordon in Penfield. Go ahead, Gordon.
I'm a gun owner, and I just want to go on record as saying I'm all for gun registration and licensing. And I think the model should be along what's similar to automobiles. You need to prove that you know how to operate one. It should be licensed. You should have a license to operate it, and you should have, and it should be registered. And, I have no problem with the state requiring registration of assault rifles or whatever they deem to be assault rifles. And I think the argument that just because they make people feel powerful is not a reason to register them is ridiculous, because machine guns, bazookas make people feel powerful. They're great for home defense, but they're not legal either. And, we're trying to define the line here. And I think assault weapons are very similar to pistols, especially, the semi-automatic. So I have no problem with the Scope Act.
With the SAFE Act. Gordon, thank you. Gary Putup. Gary Putup is here from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. He's a retired police lieutenant. Gary, your thoughts?
Well, I think Gordon and I are on the same page. And again, as a gun owner, I have no problem with registering my guns. I have no problem with, the restrictions that the SAFE Act places. I think it's important to remember that, when people talk about rolling back the SAFE Act, we're talking about rolling back things as simple as what Gordon said, a criminal background check before somebody purchases, a weapon. This isn't something that's out there, so to speak. It might be out there maybe with our gun culture in America, but it's certainly not considered out there or different than, any other, most countries and certainly most advanced countries bring out. I would like to clarify something, because I always do carry a copy of D.C. Heller with me, and to bring out that, Heller, to be clear, Heller states, and I'm going to just quote here, like most rights, the Second Amendment right is not unlimited, is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for whatever purpose. And I would go back to this, the Scope says, in their newsletters and in their publications and in their public, that they believe that this is unconstitutional. But I'm still looking for something that was going to sit back and somebody say to me, here's a case. Here is what we have. I mean, if people understand how even our court system works in New York, to get something up to an appellate level, and certainly the highest, our Court of Appeals, you have to show not only that you have a case, but you're likely to win. And you have a good argument. And we've yet to hear one good argument as to why the SAFE Act violates the Second Amendment.
All right. Well, before I get back to the phones, which I'll do in a moment, my other guest is Chris Eads, chair of the Monroe County chapter of SCOPE. And Chris, the SCOPE stands for?
Shooters Committee on Political Education.
Okay. And when it comes to legislation, we saw nothing in this last session in Albany. Did that surprise you? Did you expect any effort to actually amend the SAFE Act in the session?
Unfortunately, no, because of without getting into the whole political situation too much, I mean, we don't have a lot of confidence in the Republican leadership in the state Senate, or the Democratic leadership in the Assembly, right? I mean, Silver was replaced by, basically another corrupt politician, in my personal belief. Flanagan seems to be the same kind of political player that Skelos was. And, the the political establishment, you know, has a certain agenda, and they don't want to rock the boat. I mean, we could have tied, right, repeal or reform of the SAFE Act to rent control, and there's a big push to do that. But a lot of the contributors to the Republican state senators are, you know, real estate people, and they have a lot of interest in not upsetting the status quo with regard to this situation. So we did not really expect the Republicans to take that opportunity and really stick to principle.
Yeah, Flanagan, he's talking about, is the new leader of the state Senate, Bill Nojay, who is a Republican assemblyman, again, who was invited on to come on this program and declined. He has been vociferously anti-SAFE Act. He said that Flanagan had a chance to unite the Republican Party, unite the effort against the SAFE Act, and essentially failed. And he was disappointed in that. Gary, what did you see in this legislative session? Nothing happened. Do you consider this a victory on your side?
Well, no. Yeah, actually, yes, we do. And actually, some things did happen. One, I don't think myself or our organization views all politicians as corrupt. And I would caution against, you know, saying, you know, one corrupt leader is obviously replaced by another corrupt leader. I don't think there's any evidence that Hastie or Flanagan are necessarily corrupt. And I think we have to be careful when we use that kind of language. I think one of the things it does show is that Scope and the NRA went in there thinking that this was a very unpopular law and there was going to be this this tide to get things changed. And as you, I know you're well aware, there have been three statewide surveys conducted, independent surveys by Siena Poll and some others, that have showed that there is a silent majority, just like Gordon, that takes no issue with the registration of assault rifles. And I think what happened is a Scope walked into Albany and found that, you know, in the end, these politicians are sitting back and saying, well, you know what, the fact of the matter is the majority of New Yorkers like this law. And I would like to point out this, that we actually had, not only the victory in that this was the time, if anything, for these people to try to roll back the SAFE Act, but we actually made progress this year in passing, and Chris referred to it, a safe storage bill, a statewide safe storage bill. Now, Rochester, Buffalo, Westchester County, New York City, and some other cities have Safe Storage Act. Again, Rochester, the city of Rochester, has one. And we hope to get that passed through the Senate, because we're pretty sure Cuomo would sign this. And what this would do is close a loophole in the SAFE Act that if there's a child in the house, it would require safe storage. And two things that happened within the last few weeks really point out and illustrate the need for such safe storage. One is the escape from Dana Moore, where unsecured guns were found and could very well have been used against law enforcement officers. And just last week, I don't know if you're aware of this, there was a burglary in Greece, and unsecured long guns and handguns were stolen. I was in Albany a few weeks back and had an opportunity to talk with Mike Green, who's the head of the Department of Criminal Justice Services. And the Department of Criminal Justice Services has done a study and finding that most of the guns that are committed in crimes in this part of the state, specifically Monroe County and Rochester, are not necessarily guns brought in from out of state as they are, like, say, in New York City, but they are actually, the crime guns are used, are found in burglaries or stolen out of people's cars. And so I think this last legislative session was actually a victory for us in both those respects.
Okay. Chris, response there?
Safe storage is not something where, you know, I think people really, gun owners really, you know, strongly have a desire to draw the line, you know, especially with, you know, technology making things easier. I mean, I do think it can get out of hand once you go down that road, because there's a reason that there aren't any gun stores in the city of Rochester. It's not that you can't have a gun store, it's just that there's so many regulations. And in fact, it's you have to have bars on your windows of a certain type. You have to have a certain kind of security alarm. There's a whole list of regulations as to how you have to, you know, have your gun store, and with the result being that it's impossible to have a gun store, and even the Rochester Police Department buys their guns from Greece because we've effectively zoned out gun stores, you know, with some, you know, variation on the theme of safe storage. So I think that can definitely go too far. Whether there are, you know, some things that would not be a great burden, you know, I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is, you know, where does this lead ultimately?
Let me get back to the phones, and this is Mike in Rochester. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi there. Very interesting discussion. I just want to point out something for those who are listening. If you look at magazines for those who like firearms, pistols and especially Bushmaster-style rifles, you call them the AR-15, but that's really the military designation, I believe. But Bushmaster-style rifles are touted in those magazines for their military-style uses because they have pistol grips, because you can put scopes on them to hit something at a great distance, because you can fire bullets at a great rate of fire. I'm not sure what the top speed of a Bushmaster is, but I know you can get rid of 30 rounds pretty quickly. I would then ask the gentleman from Scope, and I have attended a Scope meeting. It was a very strange experience. I would ask the gentleman from Scope, what firearms would you deny outright to Americans? And I don't count a grenade launcher, sir, as a firearm. That's more like an artillery piece. What firearms would you deny to Americans, period? I think there are some guns that we don't need. I would put the Bushmaster in there, but certainly anything that can fire at a higher rate of speed, which is not used for hunting but used for killing people, I think I would be concerned about allowing those to be owned.
Mike, thank you for the call. Chris, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the grenade launcher, actually, just to be clear, is one of the features. It's something you could add to a gun to make it an assault weapon. So that's, you know, that's why how I came to mention that.
And you'd say no to that?
Right. Yes. Okay. No, yes, I can see the grenade launcher making a weapon, you know, substantially more dangerous, right? I don't think there's any
disagreement. I could see that.
There.
Yeah, I think we agree. Yeah. But where do you agree with him on drawing the line then?
Well, okay, so this is the thing, right? You know, you may want a high rate of fire for competitions, right? I mean, when you're talking about, or you may want it for a self-defense situation. I mean, let's, you know, not at this time would we be worrying about, you know, descending into riots or something, having to protect your family from a mob. But, you know, that sort of situation could come up. And the thing is, right, when you're talking about a constitutional right, you have a high bar for restricting it. And I think, so when you look at, you know, where I would draw the line, you know, the question is probably, like, I mean, it's hard to say, right? I mean, arms. Let's take the word arms, right? And I think, you know, what is meant by that is something you could carry in your arms, right? So, if, for instance, something like a machine gun that require like a tripod mount, I think that would not be protected under the Second Amendment because it's not, in that sense, something you could carry about with you. You know, it's and so I think I would draw the line there. I mean, the question of, say, fully automatic weapons, I mean, in that, when you're in like the kind of situation that we're concerned about, even having a fully automatic weapon, I mean, that a fully automatic weapon, you hold the trigger down and it empties the whole clip, and it does so pretty fast. And that's really kind of a waste of ammunition, unless you're, you know, in an infantry regiment or something. So I think even that, it doesn't, a fully automatic weapon versus a semi-automatic weapon does not really make it that much more dangerous in the kind of situation we're talking about. So I would say, you know, probably I would draw the line is this something that you could pick up and carry around, you know, that an average person could pick up and carry around? And if so, then I would allow someone to possess that. If it's something that's you know, a heavier weapon, then I think we can stop and say that that's just not the kind of thing that people are going to use in, you know, for hunting or target shooting and defense.
Gary?
You know, Evan, this is where I think I'm at. When we start talking about things like rates of fire for competition, when there is so much human pain and suffering, as we saw in South Carolina and Aurora and Sandy Hook, I mean, at times I have to sit back and say, my God, what are we talking about? If we could just step back from this conversation and start thinking about the people are dying and families are suffering, and we're having conversations about establishing rates of fire. If I think there's some good examples of where we can go with this that still allows gun owners to do what they have to do in regards to things like those that live in rural areas that need them for feral animal control, for in-home self-defense and whatnot. And one of the best examples, and again, I bring these examples up because we are not going into uncharted territory. We are now at the point, and this is almost very if analogous to anything, is the Confederate flag controversy. We know what that meant, and we know what the answer is. At this point in time, we know we have a gun problem. We have a gun problem, we have a gun violence problem, and we know what the answers are. We can take a country like Australia or a country like Canada, again, which was a frontier nation just like ours, founded under a British system. And when they decided to get to limit their firearms, keep in mind in Australia and in Canada, you can still own firearms. But for instance, in Australia, you're not allowed to own anything, a semi-automatic rifle or shotgun, center fire with more than 5 rounds. Rim fires are 10 rounds. Everything is registered. They do that in Switzerland too. Everything is registered. All transactions are recorded. There's universal background checks. We know this. We know this works. So why we're having conversations about rates of fire when there's so much suffering, I think it's time for us to move forward.
Well, Gary, I mean, let's you know, from my perspective, let's turn this around. I mean, we're talking about the gun-free zones, right? I mean, when we see this kind of human suffering, the idea that we would have a gun-free zone, that we would prohibit people from having weapons in self-defense, and, you know, and I should have brought a list because I can think of, there have been at least a dozen of these situations that don't get reported on the media, where someone has a gun and puts an end to this sort of reign of terror.
You know, I'm glad, if I could talk about guns.
Gary, you got to let him go. Go ahead.
Can I finish making my point?
Please.
So in my mind, that the fact that people advocate for these gun-free zones that reduce people to helpless victims while someone is walking around killing people, when they could, if they had a concealed carry permit and have gone through that whole background check, be able to return fire, that's what I think is really heartless in the context of the discussion that we're having. And I think we have not a gun problem. We have a gun control problem because people are not allowed to defend themselves and they have to sit there helplessly while they're picked off.
If I could. So
please be brief here because I'm going to try to get a couple other comments.
I'm glad you brought the gun-free zone thing up because there are two professors, a study out of Yale that shows, and actually if we sit and think about this, there's no evidence that these gun-free zones are chosen because they're quote-unquote gun-free zones. The shooter at Virginia Tech had a problem with people at the personnel at Virginia Tech. The shooter in Charleston went there not because it was a gun-free zone, because he didn't like black people at this particular church with this history. The shooter in Aurora didn't go to a gun-free zone because it was a gun-free zone. He went to that theater because it was a Batman movie and he believed he was the Joker. The shooter at Sandy Hook went to that school not because it was a gun-free zone, because he had an issue with someone at that school. That it's very easy to look at it and say, well, these are gun-free zones. But I mean, again, to make this argument that somehow, and we look at the victims of Charleston, look at the primarily women. I mean, are we really at the point where we're going to make an argument where an 80-year-old woman who's going to Bible study should be packing heat to shoot it out with a white supremacist? That's the problem. We really need to reset and think about what we're doing.
All right, I'm gonna kick it to Chris to finish the program. Both Klessen and Tim write to the program with an important point that we have not mentioned. You do have an option to modify your assault-style rifle under the law, and we don't know how many people have, but that certainly could be a portion of the people who own these style weapons, so that's possible. I don't think anybody disagrees. So we don't know that number, but Klessen and Tom, thank you for pointing that out. That's a good point. And the last quick question, we got about a minute left here. Pete says the discussion is missing the forest for the trees. Doing a search on Wikipedia shows that gun deaths per 100,000 people are about 10 in the U.S., 0.46 in the U.K., 0.06 in Japan. And how come we are not talking about those issues? So I know you've heard it before. Chris, why do you think that disparity exists?
Oh, well, that's simple, because we're comparing gun violence with gun violence and not all violence. Once you account for the fact that people are using knives and baseball bats and socket wrenches to commit violent crimes, then those numbers become a lot more even.
Do they kill as many people with those things?
I can't offhand answer that. But that's a very common misconception, and people like to use statistics that relate, you know, guns with guns, whereas in fact, if you relate violence with violence and incorporate all the tools, then we see a lot more parity.
And Chris, last words, because I know Gary doesn't like me saying this, but there's nothing that, in these stats that indicate to me that people are actually registering their assault rifles at a high rate. 20 seconds. Is that going to change? Do you think people who own assault-style rifles in the state will start following the SAFE Act?
No, I do not think so.
Simple as that. Gary?
One, that's sad. And two, Evan, I guess that just means you're going to have us back.
Okay, well, we'll certainly have more to talk about. And I know we had a lot of comments and questions and phone calls we could not get through. Chris and Gary are always cordial with each other, and I appreciate both of their time. And Gary doesn't like, again, like I said, didn't like hearing it. But those numbers do not indicate a high rate of compliance yet. Maybe that will change. We'll see. Maybe Scope is right. Chris, thank you. Thank you, and thanks
You're
to
welcome.
Scope. Gary Putup, thanks to you.
Thanks, Evan.
New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Short break, and we're talking next hour about nonviolent practices.